Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Zuleika. She is the founder and director of the Story Dancer Project, and she will be performing along with Coleman Barks, David Darling, and Glenn Velez in an event on Tuesday, the 18th of December, called The Rumi Concert, Lion of the Heart, at the Lensic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe in honor of the poet Rumi's 800th birthday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. The upcoming concert honors Rumi, and we're going to have Coleman Barks, the great translator of Rumi, on the show in a little while. He's a poet himself, and he's part of the performance. But before we get into talking about that, let's find out more about you. How did you begin your life as a dancer and a storyteller? You grew up in a family of classical musicians.
I did. My parents played classical music, and we grew up going to symphony rehearsals and doing our homework in the symphony hall, maybe running around a lot. But we were very influenced by music, and I love music. I think my whole family would say maybe our tradition that we fall back into is music, and that, of course, made me want to wiggle around a lot, move around a lot.
Music leads to dance.
Yeah, I know it does, doesn't it? When you hear something so beautiful or so the beat's catchy, it makes you start moving, and then when you start moving, you feel better. And I think I probably figured that out a long time ago. When I was around 12, my mother took me to Anna Halperin, a very great avant-garde dancer who believed in natural movement and believed that if you found the way your body would move, that would be very interesting. So we spent many, many hours finding out what does it feel like when your backbone moves? What does it feel like when your arm moves? Instead of looking to see what it looks like, we felt what it felt like. And that was a very different approach. It still is, although I think people are getting that idea more these days.
Now, natural movement is, when you think of all the different dance traditions in the world, they're so different. I mean, what part of it is natural?
Well, I think what is natural is being ourselves. And that's, of course, a huge subject. How do you be yourself? When are you not yourself, really?
And what does yourself mean? Because it's so much bounded by the cultural construct in which you grow up.
So when you start moving around, let's say you just start moving your hands, and you're moving your hands, and you're moving your hands, and suddenly you go, oh, I have hands. It's kind of like a no-brainer. Yes, we have hands, but what do they feel like? And what do they feel like in space? And that leads to something else. Oh, they're connected to my arms. Oh, I have toes that are like fingers. Well, not exactly alike, but they move the same way. So it's an exploration on the inside. And what happens is it starts to take one into a greater awareness. That is our birthright. The only way you can get here as a human being is to be born in one of these things we call bodies. It's like a miraculous spacesuit. And everyone is encoded differently with fingerprints that are unique. So moving around and finding out how your body moves allows me to get free in some place where there might have been an ache or a pain or some kind of I was bound somewhere. So from there I went, that was many, many years of that kind of work. And that turned into theater, and her teachers at the time when I met her were Ida Rolf, who started Rolfert work, the body work, and Fritz Perl. So we did a lot of experimental psychological work while we were moving. That somehow led me into questioning, what is this about, really? And somehow
this with a capital T.
Yeah, this with a capital T. And somehow that catapulted me, in a longer story, into the Ali Akbar College of Music, classical, North Indian classical music.
So you then went to classical North Indian music, and you studied with Ali Akbar Khan and Ravi Shankar. That was even before you went abroad, I think. What was the nature of those teachings?
Well, actually, I didn't study exactly with Ravi Shankar, but he was the first one with Ali Akbar Khan to bring Indian music to the Western awareness. And then Ustad Ali Akbar Khan started a college. And in India and in other cultures, it is thought that music, inside of music, is singing, playing an instrument, and what they call the rhythmic art of ecstasy, or we call it dance. So if you want to study dance, you have to study music, which is such an amazing combination.
And something a lot of dancers here don't do.
Right. It's very interesting. It's very different to have to be responsible for the melody and the rhythm in the movement, instead of just counting or going along with some abstraction. Both are interesting, both are happening right now, but that's what led me into a deeper communication with music.
And you learn some instruments along the way.
Well, I grew up playing piano. The background sound is loud this morning. I grew up playing the piano, and for many years, the rule in our family was you had to play the piano if you wanted to play any other instrument. And we all wanted to play other instruments. So I also played silver flute and guitar much later. But so music was already embedded in my awareness. And so I did study a little bit of Indian classical flute. But then I studied singing, and I play the harmonium, and I create songs.
What's the harmonium?
Harmonium is a little piano. It's like a half of an accordion that sits on the floor and you pump it, or on a table. Actually, it came from Europe, and then somehow it was brought to India, and then it became part of Indian classical music and kirtan music, devotional music.
Now, you went to Afghanistan in the 1970s, I think, and what was the nature of your studies there?
Well, in Afghanistan, I went at the end of the 70s, and a friend of mine had met a very great royal classical musician, a family of royal classical musicians, and I had a great meeting with them and ended up staying there for some time studying music. And there I studied classical singing of the North Indian variety, which I hadn't realized spanned India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And so I lived in a house of classical music and woke up every morning and drank tea and practiced singing. And that very much influenced my understanding of melody and rhythm. And it enforced a kind of stream in my dancing that I wouldn't have expected, but it did.
Now, I saw that movie Lachodrome, which was about the trajectory of the music and dance of gypsies from India all the way across to France and Spain. And you're talking about a similar movement. Are you talking about music of the same roots, or is it something different?
It's similar. It's the classical version of what you saw in the movie. But it's so interesting how music and dancing and art and all culture have morphed their way around the world. We tend to think that it stays in one place and it grows, which it does, but people come. People have always come in and influenced other people. There have always been somebody who has crossed the great mountains, who has walked into a village and had a new song that no one ever heard, or a new dance that no one had ever seen. And someone else was touched by that, and they met, and they had an exchange, and they agreed to share their wealth. You see, because in the ancient way, this is the wealth, the story, the music, the dance, the art. It's a currency, it's a form of sharing. So people didn't really steal it, they shared it.
We're talking to Zuleika, and she is part of an event called the Rumi Concert, Lion of the Heart, at the Lenzing Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe on Tuesday of next week, December 18th. What is the relationship between music and the story? Your project is called Story Dancer.
Yeah.
The music, the dance, and the story, they're all somehow related.
Yeah, they are. They're intertwined. You know, in every culture in the world, the way that people have kept what is important to be remembered is through the dance, actually, and inside the dance, this kept the stories. And the stories are the nerves that the culture is founded upon and within. And so the stories are how things happen. I believe that Coleman told me a story about, in the Hebrew tradition, they say that God loved stories so much, he created human beings. And so, according to that legend, we are all walking around being our stories. When you think of it that way, that then to dance the story, to keep what is to be remembered in that way, is a very wonderful thing.
I mean, it's funny to hear you saying this, because growing up in the United States and so on, we think of stories really not as embodied. We think of them as written down on paper and specifically disembodied.
Well, if you go back to, you go in your mind into the time before television, the word television is actually tell a vision. What a story,
I mean, seeing
is
from far away.
You're telling your vision, which is what a story is, you know. So I think that stories have now morphed into, you know, film and TV and all kinds of different ways we experience stories, but they're still stories, and we still see each other and say, how are you? Oh my gosh, do you know what happened to me on my way here? That's a story. And so some of those stories are very important to culture and tradition. And some of those stories, I think, are being made now, and they line up with other stories from before.
When you were learning North Indian music and classical dance, and you were studying in Afghanistan, what was the nature of your training like, where you were trained to tell a story with music and with your body?
Well, actually, I was training that before I went to Afghanistan. Because Indian classical dancing, there are six major classical dance forms in India, and I studied one of them. And in that form, we learned how to become the characters. We learned how to take on, you study all the different emotions, anger, jealousy, greed, bliss, and then you have to feel that inside of yourself and be able to portray it, which actually takes quite a long time. It's very difficult, more than what you would think. And then you learn these ancient stories and you become all the characters in the way that I studied. At a certain point, I realized I did this for a very long time, and it's very intricate. You wear bells on your feet and do rhythms that are like flamenco with bare feet. At a certain point, I realized that I wasn't from India and I wasn't from Afghanistan, and that I loved stories, and that people loved hearing them and feeling them. And In India, I learned how to, you tell the story first and then you dance it. But I found out when I came home that nobody has time for that. And if you tell the whole story first, nobody wants to sit around and watch something they just heard. And it gave me the idea that I would rather tell it and move at the same time. And so I began to play around with that. And then I realized I wanted to tell the teaching stories from all over the world. And the way that I went about that is to get permission from different people and different cultures. When you have a story in a traditional culture, you tell a story, like let's say I would work in a school in the Pueblos here. I would never tell a story from here. I would tell a story that had been given to me from Mongolia. And one day this happened, and I told this story, and then a really wonderful storyteller, a woman, an older woman, came up to me and she said, why don't you tell our stories? Why don't you tell, we have a story like this. It goes like this. Why don't you tell our story? And that way she gave me the story. So then I was allowed to tell it.
And is there permission involved in telling somebody else's story? I mean, is that part of the deal?
There is. I don't think everyone knows that. And I think the way the world is now, all of those things are kind of morphing around. But in the correct way of manners, let's say, it would be polite. It would be a heart kind of politeness to say, you know, to meet someone and ask permission, or somehow say, this was given to me, or I was attracted to this, may I use it, may I tell it. I think I learned that from all my teachers, so I'm of that school.
We're talking to Zuleika, and once again, she'll be performing in the Rumi concert on Tuesday, the 18th of December. Why don't we play a song? And this is a song of yours from a disc whose name is, I have it in front of me here, Robe of Love. Tell us a little bit about this disc. You are singing, and you're also, did you write all the songs?
I wrote all the songs, yeah. I write music, or music, melodies come to me. I play the harmonium, and I sing, and I love the maps, as it were, the maps of the mystical poets from many different sources. This particular one is the names of the mother, divine mother, from Sanskrit. Some of the names, there's thousands of them, but these are some of them.
Let's go ahead and hear it. And that is Zuleika. The song is in Sanskrit.
Yes.
And it's called Devi Ma. That's the name of the Divine Mother.
Devi is one of the names of the Divine Mother. Now, in Sanskrit.
What are the musical roots of that song?
Well, there's a, you mean the instruments?
Yeah, the instruments and the rhythm.
The rhythm is in seven. Which is a seven-beat cycle, which is, you could say, 3 plus 4, or 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 1. When you get into music in other cultures, and what's happened to me, you start learning about all different kinds of rhythms. And I became fascinated with the rhythmic cycle of seven, which is da 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 da. And it just sort of had, you know, I kind of found myself walking around in it a lot, and that's how that came into being.
I don't know if you can answer this, I don't know if anybody can, but how do you think it affects a culture if people grow up understanding complicated time signatures? I mean, we here are just based on 2, 3, and 4, as far as I can tell.
Well, everything's based on 1, if you want to look at it that way. And then if you go into 2 and 3, there's all millions of combinations of that. And so the more that you go into it, the more you see how simple it is. Like 7 would be 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So everything comes back to 1. So it isn't really complicated. It's complicated to think about it. But once you start to feel inside of it, It's very simple. And actually, that is a big study. And that's something that occurred in me when I was studying these classical art forms for so long. It's about rhythm. My teacher in Afghanistan, Ustad Hashim Chishti, one time I said to him, I don't think I'm going to continue doing a classic, being a classical performer of classical dance from this region. I want to make my own work. And he looked at me and he said, okay, just always know where one is. And he began to do very complex combinations of rhythm for weeks and weeks, and I had to sit in front of him and keep time. And I began to formulate at that time a way of teaching people how to play inside of rhythmic cycles where they, let's say you have four, so you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Maybe you're going to accent 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Maybe you're going to accent the 2 and the 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. When you start doing that physically with your body, what happens is you're concentrating on feeling different places inside the cycle of rhythm, and you're expressing it freely. And so it's really amazing. You have to concentrate and be free at the same time, and that is a way of learning, and that is very interesting to me. I love to share that with people.
That's something you teach?
Yeah, well, I play with people in that way. Yeah.
We're talking to Zuleika, and do we have Coleman Barks on the telephone yet?
Yes, we do.
I'd like to welcome Coleman Barks. He is one of the great translators of the work of Rumi, and he will be here next week performing along with Zuleika and David Darling and Glenn Velez in the Rumi concert, Lion of the Heart. That's on Tuesday of next week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, you're considered one of the great translators of Rumi's work, and I'm pretty new to the work of Rumi. I just started reading him since Zuleika gave me your book last week. And one of the first things I was thinking about on reading his poetry is that the natural response to these poems would be other poems or other kinds of art rather than scholarly analysis necessarily. And your work seems to sort of walk a line between poetry and scholarship. Tell us about this whole process that you have had in encountering Rumi.
You know, I think you're right. I think it's the true response to a Rumi poem is to write another poem. They put us into a deep place. They're love poems, but they are love poems of a different sort, maybe, than we are used to. At the end of one of his poems, he describes the process of love as moving from his way. He says, I am a fly in your honey, then a moth caught in flame's allure, then empty sky stretched out in homage. And it's that last stage. We understand the flame and the honey part
right.
of loving, but that love's growth that moves into the image appropriate for it is empty sky. And this is something that Zuleika deals with when she works with people, too, I think. It can be reached, that stage. It can be reached through disciplines, and it can be reached through grief. But it can also be reached through love, through a deepening and an opening of the heart. So the proper response to a Rumi poem is not analysis.
Well, that's, they're so emotionally rich. I mean, it's not a book that you can read from beginning to end, right? I tried to do that. It didn't work very well. So I just opened it up to random pages here and there and read poems. And one of the things that was so striking was that this is a poet who has felt and been willing to go to emotional depths and emotional places, regardless of whether they feel good or not, and experience these things at their most intense, and then write them. That's something that probably most of us aren't really willing to do in the first place.
It is a courageous thing. I think you're right, and it's best sampled, I think, one line at a time. It involves somehow the obliteration of the lovers, and that's not something very comforting. at the stage, he says, of emptiness, the lovers somehow disappear. And I had a call once from what's the name of that big greeting card company? I just can't think of it.
Hallmark.
Yes, Hallmark. They wanted to put some Rumi on their cards, and I said, but it involves the obliteration of the lovers. And then she was quiet for a long time, and then she said, well, is there a holiday? I guess not.
Oh my goodness! Did they use any? Was it? Did they end up
no,
using
no,
any
they,
of it?
No, they decided not.
That is amazing. Well, what do you mean by that? The obliteration of the lovers. What does Rumi mean by that?
Somehow, the lovers disappear into each other and into the universe. He said the heart gets blown into such tiny bits that you can't find it, or that it's everywhere. And somehow the friendship or the love becomes not so much a relationship. He said, fall in love in such a way that it frees you from any connecting. And that's a startling thing to say. It somehow it's not about relationship. It's about some wider, more open-hearted sense of being. I don't know. Am I saying anything?
Well, it's, you know, it goes against. I mean, what's so fascinating about it is that it goes against certainly our notions of psychology or popularized psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about that in the introduction. There's something about the work and about the notions of love and connection and everything else that's irreducible to a kind of psychological or scientific or orientation. And that's something that I think a lot of us have trouble dealing with.
Uh-huh. Well, it that may be rooted in the idea that the psyche is a single thing with boundaries. And he sort of dissolves those boundaries. And somehow the psyche is a plural thing.
That includes everybody and everything.
It includes everybody and whatever anybody says.
Right.
I don't know. It also includes a lot of laughter.
Well, you've been at this for over 30 years. Can you just...
I have, and I still can't say what it is.
Right. Well, you know, it's probably a good thing, but can you describe what it's like for you to come back to this work over and over 3 decades?
I don't know. It keeps unfolding for me, and I somehow never get tired of it. I may be simple-minded, you know, but I come to it each. I do usually do a little bit every day, even if it's just 10 minutes or 15. And I'm always excited by it. I'm still an apprentice to the master.
We're talking to Coleman Barks. Go ahead.
No, I don't have anything else to say.
Well, Rumi was born at the beginning of the 13th century, and so we're celebrating the 800th anniversary of Rumi's birth. Tell us a little bit about his life and how he came to leave the legacy that is this work that we are reading and talking about.
Well, amazing life, really. It began up in the high Central Asian, what is now northern Afghanistan. And he moved down because the Mongol armies were coming, and he and his family moved down to Konya, Turkey. And the big event in his life occurred when he was about 37 probably, when he met this wild teacher named Shams of Tabriz. And Shams met him. He was teaching by a fountain, and with his books piled out on the edge of the fountain, and Shams came up and pushed the books into the fountain. And Rumi says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "You must now live what you've been reading about." And in a way, his life began then as a kind of experiencing of these continuous deepening of the heart. And It's that simple, I think. It doesn't involve doctrine. It doesn't involve beliefs. It involves the experiencing of a deepening in the heart. And that's what his community was about. And it's why people from all religions came to his funeral, Christian and Jew and Muslim and Hindu and Buddhist, because they said, he deepens us wherever we are. And so he is a kind of a planetary poet now. He's a poet for all religions and all peoples, and it has been recognized as such. And so I think that's why he's important at this particular time, because he is such a dissolver of boundaries. And we think of ourselves, he says, if you think of yourself as a Christian or Jew or Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu, he says, then if you think that's an important way to divide up the world, then you're making a division between your heart, what you love with, and how you act in the world. And that was a radical thing to say in the 13th century, and it's a radical thing to say now.
Well,
but he said it with such clarity and gentleness that they didn't kill him.
Right. I mean, I was thinking about that when contemplating how far we have or have not come in the last 8 centuries, and I was thinking that maybe one of the things this work teaches us is that there's no human progress at all, that every age has its wisdom, and that wisdom doesn't seem to manage to bring peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Buddha lived like 2,500 years ago, didn't we? We certainly haven't assimilated the wisdom that he brought to us. And Jesus, too. The wisdom seems to be outside of time and always accessible. But yeah, we still haven't learned a thing, have we?
I just don't know. It seems like individuals learn something, but as a society, we don't seem to assimilate it.
Uh huh. We've got to be more generous with our wisdom. I don't know. It's astonishing how cruel we can be.
When we talk about Rumi and this great event in his life, the meeting of this teacher Shams of Tabriz, what one might call the great love of his life? And, you know, what kind of love are we talking about?
Uh-huh. Well, that's the mystery of these poems. They all come out of that friendship. And I say it's that friendship that is described by the empty sky. In one way, it's described by many different metaphors, and perhaps it can't be understood until it is experienced. And I think we're on the way to learning what that emptiness is and how beautiful it is. We're sort of afraid of emptiness, aren't we? And silence.
Well, and even knowing what those words mean, I mean, silence, I think we can get our heads around, but what is emptiness?
Well, it's hard to say. It's what's not there.
But it's a theme in Rumi's work.
I just know it when I see it in another human being. you can feel some people have a depth of silence inside them, you know? That somehow the chattering of the mind is stopped. And you feel great relaxation when you're in their presence. And that's one way, I think, of knowing that depth. This is a strange thing to talk about, isn't it, on a radio program?
It is. I mean, silence is something that is, we call it dead air.
Yeah, that's beautiful, yeah. Yeah, silence is evidently not dead air.
We're talking to Coleman Barks, the translator of Rumi. Is there a poem or two that you'd like to read for us?
You want to hear a poem, a part of a poem. Let's see. Time's knife slides from the sheath as a fish from where it swims. Being closer and closer is the desire of the body. Do not wish for union. There is a closeness beyond that. Why would God want a second God? Fall in love in such a way that it frees you from any connecting. Love is the soul's light, the taste of morning. No me, no we, no claim of being. These words are the smoke the fire gives off as it absolves its defects as eyes. In silence, tears, face. Love cannot be said. I love that. But it's the taste of mourning. He said, love is the taste of mourning. That's, that's glorious.
Mourning, meaning grief, or mourning like the first part of the
day?
Oh,
mourning without the U. Mourning without the U. Yes, that's what it is now. The what's outdoors all around us.
Now,
that morning.
You have translated this work. What do you think is lost in translation? I mean, when you're looking at the original Persian, and maybe that's not something that you've dealt with as much.
No,
but
I work with scholars. So they give me literal versions, and so I would know what is lost in translation, but I hope some of the sense of... He says, Rumi says, listen for presences inside poems. Let them take you where they will. Go with those and follow those private hints, he says, and never leave the premises. So he says somehow through language, a sense of a presence comes through, of a consciousness comes through. And maybe in his case, the friendship that he had with Shams comes through the language, hopefully even through translations, as maybe, you know, the Chinese can read a translation of Shakespeare and get a sense of the magnificent imagination at play there. And it's the same that we in American English, we can maybe get a sense of this heart master that Rumi was and Shams, his teacher.
Stay with us for a moment, Coleman Barks. Zuleika, who's sitting here at the table with us in the cafe.
Hi, Coleman.
Hey, Swanee.
How did you get into the study of Rumi yourself and bring it into this concert type of work?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, well, I've been reading Rumi for a long, long time, and I actually had been reading the archaic translations before I met Coleman. And when I met Coleman, I found what he was doing completely available. And since I had been trained in ways of working with the word and poetry from the East, where you go inside of a phrase of poetry and you interpret it more deeply each time you do it, that's a specific practice that I had been trained in classical dancing. I thought, well, I would really love to do this with Coleman, with the poetry of Rumi, and he was amenable. We did our first performance at the Elliott Bay bookstore. I stood on a box, and he stood on another box, and he read this beautiful poetry, and I danced in this about as big as this table that we're sitting at, and it was wonderful. So we continued gracefully and amazingly somehow.
Coleman, what are the different ways that you've seen the poetry of Rumi expressed? I mean, this concert is one of them. People read it alone, people read it aloud. What is your experience over the years of seeing Rumi's expressed in the world?
I'm always interested in the way that music can help the words go deeper into the psyche, and movement, too. So that's the way they're supposed to be heard, with music and movement. And so we have just gotten the idea that poetry is something to be read in our secret private garret, you know. It's more available, I think, when you do it in a group and as a public thing, and with all sorts of music, and with a movement too, interpreting the phrases as they arrive. And it's always new to me. It's always something, I find something new in the poetry when I hear them this way.
Zuleika, musicians David Darling and Glenn Velez will also be with us. How did you start working with those two?
Well, I met David quite a long time ago and collaborated with him, and Glenn as well, and I think and Coleman had met them himself, and then I think we just came together a long time ago. We've been trying to continue ever since.
Is the essence of their music somehow expressive of Rumi?
I think that David has this unique quality of being able to play anything on the cello, and it goes very deep, and he can be playful. And Glenn is a master of rhythm. And the way that we have been doing this, as Coleman really beautifully said, it arises new every time. So we may understand the poems, or we may know them, or we may have read them many, many times, but when we're in that moment, we're all there together anew. And these musicians are so adaptable and creative and articulate in their forms that the moment becomes apparent for everyone present, the audience and the performers.
Is it a little bit different each time?
Yeah.
Are they improvising?
Yeah. I don't even know if I'd say improvising. I'd say listening. And because they're so trained and so articulate that they're inspired. I would say it's about inspiration in the moment, but it comes with a big field of study and a big understanding.
Now, the concert is called the Rumi Concert Lion of the Heart, and for those just tuning in, it's on Tuesday, December 18th, right here in Santa Fe at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. What does the term Lion of the Heart mean? And maybe this is a question for each one, for you, go ahead, for Coleman Barks.
Well, it comes from a poem that I may not be able to remember right now, but he says, Lion of the Heart, roar and tear me open. So the lion of the heart is that courage that is willing to be torn open and to tear open. It's that quality of the psyche, the lion quality, which is a beautiful thing to feel.
Yeah, I think it brings to mind for me that place in that's very secret inside of us that longs to be courageous, that longs to be to speak the truth. And when you're torn open in that place, you're free to come forth with that joy that is longing to be present.
Now, the work that you're doing is part of a much larger project called the Story Dancer Project, and I was Zuleika, yeah. And one of the many projects that you're working on is bringing girls together, and there's one part which is called Girl to Girl, Teenage Girls in San Francisco talking to teenage tsunami victims in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And when I was thinking about people encountering each other's pain with courage, that's something that necessarily must happen in a project like this. Tell us about it.
Well, actually, it's Civil War orphan girls are going to be in communication with the teenage girls in San Francisco.
Oh, okay. I was putting two together.
Yeah, it's okay. We're doing another project with Tsunami Girls as well. And through the internet, but also through movement, I've come up with 8 wellness core exercises that I've tried out in all manner of places in the world, and these girls love those, and so each group of girls will be participating in those, and they're going to communicate through the subjects of what do they dream about, what do they see when they look out their windows, what kind of food do they eat. It is two very different cultures, and actually the girls in San Francisco, when they heard me talk about it, I went and did a performance at their school. They said, we don't know anything about the world outside of our world. And so that's how this became born. But I just want to say one thing, is that the Rumi concert in Santa Fe has always given some amount of proceeds to complementary care of people living with cancer in Santa Fe, and this year there's a bridge going from there to a program in India with villagers and children who live with cancer. So that's another inspiring thing we're involved in.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left, and I'd like to thank Coleman Barks so much for being with us, and you will be on stage on Tuesday of next week, actually reading the Rumi poems aloud?
Yes. Yes.
Well, we look forward to having you, and thank you so much for joining us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Zuleika, there's one or two more things I wanted to get to. We've only got about a minute left or 2 minutes, but you also work with people through movement doing, would you call it physical fitness or body awareness or whatever? I mean, you work, for example, with people working in state government who come in their suits and ties and heels and hose.
Yeah, that was I was on the Governor's Council for Health and Physical Fitness, and it became apparent to me, or has been for years, that we sit in these chairs at these tables with our computers for hours on end, and then everyone has all these aches and pains. And so in the council meetings, I got everyone up for less than a minute, and everyone felt refreshed. And out of that came a 15-minute, they called it the 15-minute minimal guide to stretch in the workplace, which I've taken way down now. But I call it Take a Minute, and it's a little book and a DVD that are about to come out of 8 wellness exercises that have been practiced in very small spaces with high heels and suits and ties or running outfits or whatever. The human body loves to stretch, and when we stretch in correct ways and simple ways without machines and all these things, those are fine too, I like them too, but when we can just take a good stretch in the middle of what we're doing, let's say every half an hour, the mind gets relieved. The tension and the stress of the body has a place to get poured out. And this empty sky that Coleman was speaking about in the Rumi poetry actually can be a felt experience. Because when we stretch, we can experience the vastness of space within our own beings. It's a very simple thing, and I've been having the odd privilege to practice and learn about it all over the world in tsunami areas, in civil war areas, in places where the children are rag pickers and they don't get to dance. We do these exercises in very small places, and it's amazing what kind of joy can come forth when you get some relief.
Well, on that note, it's actually time to go. Zuleika, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. You're a bright light in the community. It's a privilege to talk with you.
Zuleika is founder and director of the Story Dancer Project, and she will be performing along with poet and Rumi translator Coleman Barks and musicians David Darling and Glenn Velez in an event on Tuesday, December 18th, which is the Rumi Concert, Lion of the Heart, at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe in honor of the poet Rumi's 800th birthday. For tickets, you can call the Lenzic box office at 505-988-1234. And for more information on the Story Dancer Project, you can visit storydancerproject.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.